What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you drivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I am Tracy V. Wilson, and Holly Fry is on a very, very well-deserved vacation today. So I have a special guest with me. That is Eric Lars Myers. He is founder, CEO, and head brewer at Mystery Brewing Company, president of the North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild, and co-author of North Carolina Craft Beer and Breweries. And if you have not guessed already, he is here to talk to me today about the history of beer.
Hooray.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, Tracy.
I'm very glad to have you on. Eric is also a friend of mine, so... Just to put that out there at the beginning. So thank you so much for being on the show today, Eric. I'm excited to talk to you about the history of beer. I have questions that some of them are questions that I've been curious about. Some of them are things that listeners have asked us about on the show before. So I'm very happy to have somebody on the show who is very knowledgeable about this. So a while back, we did a podcast on the history of cheese. And one of the things that we talked about in that podcast was about how to make cheese. A civilization has to have animals that they have in a pasture that would produce more milk than their own young needed to survive. And the civilization would also have to know how to milk those animals and how to have some way of storing the milk to make cheese out of it later. So how does that compare to what a civilization needs to make beer?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's not that dissimilar. What it really needs is grain. Beer is and has been for thousands and thousands and thousands of years a grain-based alcoholic beverage. So really, at the end of the day, what people needed was grain and water and some place to let it sit so that it could go through a natural fermentation process. And so without agriculture, without fields of grain, it's hard to have enough grain to actually do that. There's a lot of theory that says that why humans settled down and stopped being a nomadic culture in general was because they had figured out how to make beer. And, you know, it's really heavy to carry around giant pots of water. And so in order to sit down and really get good and drunk, you needed to do it in one place. And so that's why they started villages. I think that there's just as much evidence that says that they figured out how to, you know, have agriculture and a consistent food source. And so that's probably why they were hanging out. But I think fear was probably a great secondary to that.
It was a good motivation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, once people figured out how to domesticate grain and actually have this around for use, I can imagine that the mistake of making beer, which would, you know, sort of imagine this as grain sitting in a jar somewhere that gets left out during a rainstorm, and then somebody doesn't really necessarily want to clean it up very quickly, it ferments, and, you know, maybe an animal goes and drinks it, and then somebody realizes that that animal is having a great time, or maybe even tries it themselves. That seems like a maybe not an easy mistake to make right away to discover how to make beer, but I can imagine a world in which it happened.
So do we have any idea of who that was that made that first mistake and invented beer, or how long ago it was?
So there's theories usually talk about 8 to 10,000 years ago, really right around when people were actually settling down and stopped being a nomadic culture in sort of the Fertile Crescent area of the world. In terms of, you know, what civilization, you can go back to ancient Sumerians and this kind of thing, but it probably predates any sort of organized, cities or cultures.
So there are in several cultures gods and goddesses of beer or of brewing. Do you have any cool stories about these figures in mythology?
So the real thing that comes to mind, most of the gods in history that have to do with beer are actually goddesses. Ninkasi comes to mind from Sumerian culture, in which Ninkasi was the goddess of beer. A lot of the other gods and goddesses through history were also women, because women were really the people that made beer for a really long time. All the way up until the Industrial Revolution, making beer was women's work. It was the stuff that you had to do in the home and around the kitchen. It was using a lot of the same ingredients that you were using to make bread. So it made a lot of sense to have female goddesses for beer. The ones that come to mind, particularly in sort of Christian tradition, is Saint Brigid in Ireland. She's the patron saint of Ireland, and she's one of the those appropriated saints that sort of got picked up as the church was spreading, because her existence predates Catholicism or Christianity in Ireland. But she is rumored to have actually made a lake of beer to feed the poor and turned water into beer for a leper colony. There's all kinds of really great stories in which she has spontaneously created beer in all of these places, which is in a lot of ways kind of what brewers do on a daily basis, turn water into beer. She also has a really great poem about how in heaven there's a lake of beer, which is pretty outstanding. The thing that I really want to point out, though, is that there's a lot of theory that says that when you're reading the Bible, a lot of what is referred to as wine is probably beer, because the area in which the Bible is actually set in history is actually more of a grain-based culture than a wine-based culture. People weren't really making a lot of fermented fruits. They were probably making fermented honey and fermented grain beverages. So for the most part, what you're looking at when you're looking at a translation of the Bible was something that was done in classic cultures like Italy or Rome, where they had a very wine-heavy history. So most of the time when you're reading something about wine in the Bible, they're probably actually talking about beer or mead or some sort of blend thereof, rather than sort of the traditional, you know, there's always these ideas of somebody drinking red wine while they're, you know, somewhere in the Fertile Crescent, which seems really inaccurate.
I had never thought about that, but that makes a lot of sense. Like the climate there is not quite as suitable to growing a bunch of red wine grapes.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at pictures, particular classic paintings of biblical times, and there's always this, you know, idea that people are in this incredibly fertile environment with all these grapes and there's wine and this kind of thing. But in the grand scheme of things, that really would not have been the case. You're talking about a grain culture and an area that had grain-based alcoholic beverages for thousands of years before the time of Christ.
So you were just talking about how for a really long time, making beer was women's work. But there's also this association between beer and monks and monastic life. Where does that come from?
So the history of monks and beer really goes back to this idea of charity and helping travelers and the poor when it comes to monastic traditions. So a lot of people were, or a lot of monks were creating beer not only to sustain themselves and just have a really important source of water and liquid within their own monastery, but the ability to be able to help travelers and help the poor as charity, to give something out as a nutritional value for people. For a long time, beer was really closely related to food, and really it still is in a lot of ways, because it was a really great way to make sort of, you know, liquid bread. It had a lot of good nutritional value. It probably wasn't as alcoholic as we really think about these time in these days, but it did have something that people would prize as both a source of nutrition and a source of hydration. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it was charity work. It's turned in now to this really great thing, particularly in Trappist monasteries in Europe. And there's also one in the U.S. where the funds from beer making actually go to a lot of charity work, or to keeping the you know, roofs on the buildings at the monastery and all kinds of great stuff. So it's always sort of been an arm of charity and an arm of food and beverage as just a normal way of operating through life, rather than those monks, you know, just really liking to get super drunk. Use of hops started in a monastery, all kinds of great stuff like this. But in the grand scheme of things, it was really about being then, having a big party all the time.
So you just mentioned that beer in the past was a lot more related to food. I know listeners have asked us before about how there's this perception that, the founders of the United States were basically drinking beer all the time. And does that mean that they were just kind of drunk all the time, or was the beer that they were drinking a lot different from the beer that there is today? Or is that whole idea just a misperception?
I would actually say it's probably a little of column A and a little of column B. There was certainly a lot of alcoholic consumption throughout history. And I think that the idea that people were just a little bit drunk all the time, for the most part, was probably not that much of a reach. You're talking about times, particularly as the founding of this country, in which an essential handful of people decided to fight against the largest empire the world had seen at that point. In the British Empire, I feel like you got to be a little drunk to, you know, decide to go throw boxes of tea off the side of a boat. But beer would have been a lot different. As you get closer to our time in history, it is really becoming more and more like the beer we have today. But the farther you go back, the more it is a really fast fermented beverage that is probably fairly low in alcohol for the most part. And it's going to be consumed for nutrition and probably not really for buzz. You're going to get some beer that's a little bit higher in alcohol, particularly by the probably 1700s or 1800s. People had a much better idea of, how to make beer that was high in alcohol and really consistent. But before that, when you're talking Middle Ages and upwards, it's much more of a guess. You know, people didn't really know what was happening during fermentation. It was the 1700s before, or 1800s before, people knew that yeast was a thing. Up until then, they just called it "God is good." They would put the ingredients into the same vessel that it was before, and then bubbles would happen, and then that would get them drunk. And that's really great, but it's not a really fantastic way to make a really consistent, well-worn beverage. So, I think a little column A, a little column B. I think there was a lot of drinking. You know, I think you can look at the history of a lot of European cultures that shows that, there's probably a period in which pretty much everybody in England was consuming gin all at the same time. People were probably a little drunk, but, you know, probably not in the same types of ways that we think about it now.
All right. Well, before we move on to some more questions about beer history, we're going to take a brief pause for a word from a sponsor. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing youth-activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com.
This is Ashley Iaconetti from the Ben and Ashley I Almost Famous podcast. The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights. Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect. Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Okay, to get back into our discussion about some beer history, there's a story that is widely repeated that's about how pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock because they were out of beer. Is there any truth to that?
There absolutely is. This is one of my favorite stories to tell on my tour. So basically, because beer was such a great source of nutrition and water, it was the thing that people tended to keep on boats for long ocean voyages. See, when you put water in a cask in a big barrel and put it in the hold of a ship and go across the ocean, that water is going to go rancid pretty quickly. You know, water is the building block of life. It's a great substrate for bacteria and mold to grow in. And when you're putting water inside of a barrel, no matter how great and clean that barrel is, there's a certain amount of rot that's going to sit into that wood and things are going to grow. So it was a great way to get people sick. And it's, you know, it was very clearly before the times of reverse osmosis and desalination. So when you're looking for something to keep you hydrated throughout an ocean voyage, the most sensible way to do that was beer, particularly because beer has hops. Hops are an antibacterial. And of course, beer has alcohol, and alcohol is somewhat of an antiseptic and will actually stop a lot of harmful bacteria from growing in it. There are few to no human pathogens that can live in beer. So it turns out to be a really great safe source of drinking water for these long voyages when you couldn't actually bring water with you. So when they were on their way across the ocean, they packed enough beer to keep them going on their trip. But when they got to, you know, they're planning on a 14-week journey or something like this. But when they when they got there, they realized that not only were they running out of beer, but they had to really plan for the oncoming winter so that they could make sure that they had beer to keep them going. So when they landed, they did so out of necessity. Now, they probably, if they had more beer, could have gone around and found a much more temperate and nice place to live than New Hampshire. New Hampshire is lovely, but boy, the first winters there were probably real cold. So they really had to get on land and find a good source of water, a good source of running water, so that they could actually build a brewery and have a good source of water for the winter.
So we've talked a lot about people making beer in monasteries and women making beer in the kitchen. When did making beer really turn into an industry?
Like everything else with the Industrial Revolution.
Thanks, Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, right. It's done so much for us. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, beer was really something that happened in the home. It was happening in manor houses and in farmhouses and all kinds of different places where basically you were looking for a good way to preserve some sort of grain for a longer time and, of course, preserve the source of hydration as well.
So there is a famous German beer purity law that people still follow today. That's the Reinheitsgebot. Tell me about how that was originally set down and why it has become so prominent even still today.
So the Reinheitsgebot's really interesting because in general, it's sort of a trade restriction more than it is a beer purity law. At the time in Germany, you had an area which was growing a lot of barley and a lot of wheat. And barley is particularly well suited for brewing because of its protein content and its starch content. And wheat is not because it has a high protein content. And it does not have enough enzymes to convert its own starches into sugars. And without getting really nerdy into science, suffice to say that wheat's better for bread, barley's better for beer. So at this point in history, there was a lot of local grain production and but not a lot of restrictions on where things were going. And so the Reinheitsgebot was one of many trade restrictions that popped up to sort of control where ingredients were moving from a trade restriction standpoint. So the 1516 purity law, which is what the Reinheitsgebot that people refer to, defines that beer must be made out of barley, hops, and water. And that's it. It also defines how much beer should be sold for, one pfennig per maß. It defines, where it can be sold and all kinds of wonderful things that have nothing to do with the actual ingredients of beer. Because it was referred to as the beer purity law, I think people tend to look back at it with this sort of nostalgic idea of like, oh, this is when beer was great. But you got to understand that that's before they even knew what yeast was, right? Like yeast isn't in the Reinheitsgebot. They had to amend the Reinheitsgebot in the 1850s to put yeast into it. And I just totally made up 1850s. I have no idea if that's true. But it was really late. It was after yeast was discovered by Louis Pasteur at the Carlsberg Brewery in Germany that they said, oh, well, I guess we have to put that into the law too, or otherwise we can't make beer. But it's been a pervasive law. It was actually law in Germany until the formation of the EU. And once the EU came in, it's still considered a great way to make beer, but it couldn't be something that defined beer for other countries within the confines of the EU. And so they had to allow other ingredients in beer. The hilarious part about it is that there are plenty of classic styles from Germany that don't meet the Reinheitsgebot, and people have just found ways around it. You could get ducal permission to make beer with wheat and all kinds of stuff like this. There's lots of beers in Germany that have salt added and coriander and all of these other things that are added to the beer, but somehow people sort of ignore the fact that those don't fall under the Reinheitsgebot. They're still wonderful classic German styles that taste delicious. In America, we tend to romanticize it quite a bit in our breweries here, particularly the German style lager breweries, in which this beer can't get more pure than this, and it's a wonderful romantic ideal that doesn't really bear truth to the rest of the world, because you've got a world full of brewing cultures in which putting all kinds of other things into beer is perfectly fine. And those things can make amazing flavors. You know, without the Reinheitsgebot, we wouldn't have rye beers and we wouldn't have most of our Belgian styles. And, you know, you'd never have a fruit beer. And all of the great stuff that we innovate and create in America would not exist with the Reinheitsgebot in place. On the other hand, it is the base of all beer. All beer is made with the four ingredients of barley, hops, water, and yeast. And it's the simplest, easiest way to make beer.
So all of those other things are additions, not instead of.
Right.
So you just mentioned these wonderful beer styles in Germany and in Belgium. There are so many vastly, vastly different styles of beer today that taste so much different from one another. How did all of these different styles come about?
So, you know, there's a lot of fun stories out in the world about how different styles were created, and most of them are just stories. There's not a lot of evidence that shows that any particular style was invented here or there. Most of them grew out of local brewing traditions, just brewing with what they had locally available to them. The type of water that they were brewing with in their local rivers, and the grain and hops and ingredients that were growing near them in the world sort of came together naturally to create the types of beers that eventually became associated with styles. So a lot of styles are sort of worked backwards. I think that my guess is that until home brewing became a really prevalent hobby in the U.S. that people didn't really think about a lot of styles up until then. We have a tendency to categorize things in America. We really like to put things in boxes, which is funny because we tend to like to break out of those boxes as often as possible. But I suspect that for the most part, a lot of the defined styles that we deal with today are sort of modern inventions by way of meaning that the reason that we call them is that sometime in the past 50 to 100 years, somebody said, oh, we should categorize these things in a certain way. Not because any one thing was intended as an invented style. The only couple that come to mind are Pilsner Urquell. Is the sort of archetypical Pilsner. It was the very first Pilsner in the world, and it was made first in Pils in the Czech Republic, basically because there was a brewer there that was making headway with the new malting process that didn't leave the malt very dark or smoky. So it was the first time you had really bright, light, sweet malt. And Pils in the Czech Republic has incredibly soft water and, of course, a lot of local hops in the Czech Republic. And putting those all together really made the first beer of its type, this really bright, clear, hoppy but not bitter Pilsner beer. And it's called a Pilsner because it originated in Pils, Czech Republic. And from there, people really liked that beer and started repeating it. And it's essentially how we have most of the light lagers that we have in the world today are built off of that sort of archetypical Pilsner style. But for a really long time, any given beer made in Germany was named after the town that it was from, or in Austria or Bohemia, which is why you have Dortmunder or I'm going to remember other things, Vienna Lager or Munich Lager, all kinds of these great styles just built out of the fact that they were made in a town using what was local rather than something that somebody tried to invent specifically.
So I have a few more beer questions, which we will get to after another quick word from a sponsor. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all 5 of her best-selling products, including the amazing youth-activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing 5-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory 5-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at meaningfulbeauty.com.
This is Ashley Iaconetti from the Ben and Ashley I Almost Famous podcast. The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights. Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect. Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
So to get back to our beer conversation, earlier we were talking about how beer used to be really made primarily by women. And today, at least in the United States, the beer industry seems to be pretty male dominated, and beer is heavily marketed toward men, with sometimes beers for women being marketed as like girly beers. How did that transition come? You sound very chagrined. How did that transition come about?
Well, it really does come down to the Industrial Revolution, when people were starting to, you know, create factories. Factories were not a place for women for the most part. And beer became a really big business. As soon as you could make it in really high quantities and move it around, you could sell it and make a lot of money. And so it became an industry just like so many other things in our history, and really moved out of the home and into the factory. It's really taken until probably the last decade or so for women to really get back into the brewing industry in a really meaningful way. I think if you were to look at the brewing industry now, as opposed to 5 or 10 years ago, you would see a significant higher, much more significant number of women in it. I know from my experience, my staff at my brewery is about 85% women. And not because I, you know, particularly try to hire women so much as those just were the best people for the job. There's just a lot more women interested in the industry now. Women are particularly good tasters. And a lot of the professional tasters in the industry are women because they have very delicate and very good palates. Among the best, you know, sort of blenders in the new sour beer industry and are women. And a lot of the, you know, most storied brewers in our country are starting to be women as well. It's really nice to see it sort of coming full circle and becoming more of a co-ed industry, because it really is where it started.
So it seems like every year or so, somebody finds an old beer in a shipwreck. Either decides to drink it or decides to use the yeast to make a new beer. We've talked about these. We do these episodes, our unearthed episodes at the end of every year, and it seems like we've told that story a couple of times. This year we're not. We have one that's about a surprising discovery of how early barley was being used to make beer in China, which is earlier than people previously thought. It seems to be just a very frequent thing of, oh, here is a shipwreck with some beer. We're either going to drink this beer or we're going to make we're gonna try to get the yeast and make a new beer out of this beer's yeast. How often does that actually turn out to be a good idea?
I would suspect that drinking the beer is probably not a great idea. You know, even though it's been cold and pressurized and, you know, and down there, it probably just doesn't taste very good. It could be great, but I suspect that what's mostly happened in that bottle is a lot of yeast death. When yeast die, they burst and, you end up getting the contents of the cells inside of the beer, and it sort of tastes soy saucy. It's a very umami kind of brothy flavor, which is just not always pleasant. It can be very good, but, you know, for the most part, beer, particularly really old beer from hundreds of years ago, was really meant to be drunk fresh rather than aged 200 years in the bottom of the ocean. The yeast, on the other hand, if there are surviving yeast cells, will almost definitely allow new beer to be made. And I have not read about any successful beers being made from old recovered bottles, but I have heard about yeast being recovered from amber from prehistoric times, Saccharomyces strains that have been used to make beer, and getting sort of like, I believe it's like dino beer or something on the West Coast, where somebody's actually grew a yeast strain that was trapped in amber and was able to make beer with it. So it's definitely been done. I think that they have some particularly neat flavor profiles, but they're not that widely known about or used quite yet.
Awesome. So the last question that I have for you, I know this is a question that you love to answer. There is a very famous quote about beer that is attributed to Ben Franklin, which is that beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy.
Yeah, it's one of the things that it, you know, it's so pervasive in the beer industry, and it's such a wonderful sentiment that it's hard to be really angry about. But I'm kind of a really pedantic nerd when it comes to a lot of things. And so this is one of the things that kind of bugs me, particularly because Ben Franklin didn't say that. I actually have the quote that he wrote. And so I'm going to read it to you, even though it's going to take a minute here. We hear of the conversion of water into wine at the marriage in Cana as of a miracle. But this conversion is through the goodness of God made every day before our eyes. Behold the rain which descends from heaven upon our vineyards and which incorporates itself with the grapes to be changed into wine, a constant proof that God loves us and loves to see us happy. So he was really saying that about wine. Ben Franklin didn't really like beer all that much.
He was, he didn't like a lot of things.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he's sort of a, you know, our wonderful historic curmudgeon. But he actually thought of beer as a sort of very lazy man's beverage. He used to work in a printing house in London, and the people that drove him the most nuts were the people that were drinking beer. They were the people that, you know, were sort of, there's another quote from him that says, they wanted to see from this in several instances that the water American, as they'd called me, was stronger than themselves, who drink strong beer. We had an alehouse boy who attended always in the house to supply the workmen. My companion at the press drank every day a pint before breakfast, a pint at breakfast with his bread and cheese, a pint between breakfast and dinner, a pint at dinner, a pint in the afternoon about 6 o'clock, and another when he had done his day's work. I thought it a detestable custom.
That's a lot of pints.
Yeah, well, and it is. And, you know, there was probably going back to, you know, whether or not people were drunk all the time. Yeah, they probably were. And, you know, particularly in some points of America or history, when you're living in an urban setting, it's not going to be the best smelling or wonderful place to be. And, you know, there's probably a certain amount of escapism to be had. But he was just not a big fan of beer at any time. So it's always one of those things that kind of drives me nuts when you see him quoted that way, not because it isn't a beautiful sentiment and one that he actually meant, you know, that you can look at it another way, right? God makes rain fall upon the fields, it grows barley that spontaneously turns into beer. But that's not what he said. It's a great sentiment. It's kind of like those wonderful, you know, memes on the internet that say, you shouldn't believe everything you read, signed Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
Or you read on the internet. It's been attributed because it's sort of close. But I think we should take Ben Franklin out of beer.
So is there anything else about beer that you just want to make sure, and a beer history that you want to make sure that our listeners know about before we wrap up?
Oh, gosh. If I would have been prepared for that question, I probably would have something. But no, I think this has been a lot of fun and really great.
Thank you so, so much for being on the show, Eric. So once again, that was Eric Lars Myers, founder, CEO, and head brewer at Mystery Brewing Company, among a lot of other things. And instead of our normal listener mail today, I am actually recording this from our Atlanta studio, which is not typical anymore. Eric is joining us via Skype. I have some long overdue shout outs to people who have sent things to us in the mail after just embarrassing long time of getting them, getting through everything that's on my desk. So thanks to Christina for sending a bookmark with a picture of beautiful Estonian lace on it after hearing my disaster story about my shawl that did not come out the way I intended in our knitting episode. Thanks to Ashley for sending hand silkscreened cards that say Happy Cake Day. They are delightful. Thank you to Blaze for sending handmade hats and necklaces also after our knitting episodes. Kara sent a copy of In All Its Fury, which is the book of first person accounts of the Blizzard of 1888 that we talked about in that episode. Marla from Haribo Books sent us a series of books that she wrote and illustrated. Ethan sent a documentary he made called Ghosts of the West, End of the Bonanza Trail. And Talia sent us some adorable crochet animals. They are a bunny and a kitten. My apologies for just an embarrassing delay in thanking all these folks. And if I accidentally duplicated somebody, Holly is already thanked on the show because she is very often our male thank you person. If you would like to write to us about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/mistinhistory and on Twitter at mistinhistory. Our Tumblr is mistinhistory.tumblr.com and our Pinterest is pinterest.com/mistinhistory, which we can also find us on Instagram at mistinhistory. Come to our parent company's website, which is howstuffworks.com, where you will find all sorts of information, including a lot about the science of beer. You can also come to our website, mistinhistory.com, to find show notes for this and all of our other episodes. We will have a link to where you can find Eric's book about North Carolina craft beer and breweries. You will also find show notes for all of the episodes Holly and I have worked on and some videos we have been putting up recently from our recent trip to Boston, Massachusetts. You can do all that and a whole lot more at howstuffworks.com or mistinhistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
This is Ashley Iaconetti from the Ben and Ashley I Almost Famous podcast. The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights. Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect. Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.